Chapter 18. Official Washington turns into a ghost town over the weekends. The machinery of government grinds to a halt at 5 o'clock Friday evening and hibernates until Monday morning, when it fires to life again with the obstinacy of a cold engine. Once the cleaning crews have come and gone, the huge buildings are as dead as mausoleums. What is most surprising, the phone systems are shut down. Only the tourists are out in force, crawling over the mall, throwing frisbees and swarming around the Capitol, climbing the endless staircases and staring slack-jawed at the underside of the dome. Some were peering through the iron fence around the White House around noontime when the president came out, quick-stepped across the lawn and gave a jaunty wave before entering a helicopter. He was followed by a small entourage of aides and Secret Service agents. Few of the elite press corps were present. Most were home watching baseball on TV or roaming a golf course. Fawcett and Lucas stood on the south portico and watched until the ungainly craft lifted over E Street and dissolved to a speck as it beat its way toward Andrews Air Force Base. "That was fast work," Fawcett said quietly. "You made the switch in less than 5 hours. My Los Angeles office tracked down Sutton and crammed him into the cockpit of a Navy F-20 fighter 40 minutes after they were alerted." "What about Margolin?" "One of my agents is a reasonable facsimile. He'll be on board an executive jet for New Mexico as soon as it's dusk." "Can your people be trusted not to leak this charade?" Lucas shot Fawcett a sharp look. "They're trained to keep quiet. If there's a leak, it will come from the presidential staff." Fawcett smiled faintly. He knew he was on shaky footing. The looseness of the White House staff was open territory for the press corps. "They can't spill what they didn't know," he said. "Only now will they be waking up to the fact that the man in the helicopter with them isn't the president." "They'll be well guarded at the farm," Lucas said. "Once they arrive, no one gets off the property, and I've seen to it all communications are monitored. If a correspondent figures the game, Watergate will seem as tame as an Easter egg hunt." "How are the wives taking it?" "Cooperating 100%, Fawcett answered. "The First Lady and Mrs. Margolin have volunteered to stay shut up in their bedrooms, claiming to have a virus." "What now?" Lucas asked. "What else can we do?" "We wait," Fawcett replied, his voice wooden. "We stick it out until we find the president." "Looks to me like you're overloading the circuits," said Don Miller, Emmett's deputy director of the FBI. Emmett didn't look up at Miller's negative remark. Within minutes after he had returned to the Bureau's headquarters at Pennsylvania Avenue and 10th Street, he set into motion an all-Bureau's alert, followed by a standby for emergency action of the highest priority to every office in the 50 states and all agents on assignments overseas. Next came orders to pull files, records, and descriptions on every criminal or terrorist who specialized in abduction. His cover story to the Bureau's 6,000 agents was that the Secret Service had come on evidence of a planned abduction attempt on Secretary of State Oates and other as yet unnamed officials on high government levels. "It may be a heavy conspiracy," Emmett said finally, his tone vague. "We can't take the chance the Secret Service is wrong." "They've been wrong before," Miller said. "Not on this one." Miller gave Emmett a curious look. "You've given out damned little information to work with. Why the great secrecy?" Emmett didn't answer, so Miller dropped the subject. He passed 3 file folders across the desk. "Here's the latest data on PLO kidnapping operations, the Mexican Zapata Brigade's hostage activities, and one I'm in the dark about." Emmett gave him a cold stare. "Can you be more explicit?" "I doubt if there's a connection, but since they acted strange..." "Who are you talking about?" Emmett demanded, picking up the file and opening the cover. "A Soviet representative to the United Nations, name of Alexei Lugovoy." "A prominent psychologist," Emmett noted as he read. "Yes, he and several of his staff members on the World Health Assembly have gone missing." Emmett looked up. "We've lost them?" Miller nodded. "Our United Nations surveillance agents report that the Russians left the building Friday night."
"This is only Saturday morning," Emmett interrupted. "You're talking a few hours ago. What's so suspicious about that?" "They went to great lengths to shake our shadows. The special agent in charge of the New York Bureau checked it out and discovered none of the Russians returned to their apartments or hotels. Collectively, they dropped from sight."
"Anything on Lugovoy?"
"All indications are he's straight. He appears to steer clear of the Soviet mission's KGB agents.
And his staff?
None of them have been observed engaging in espionage activities either. Emmett looked thoughtful for several moments. Ordinarily, he might have brushed the report aside, or at most ordered a routine follow-up. But he had a nagging doubt. The disappearance of the President and Lugovoy on the same night could be a mere coincidence.
"I'd like your opinion, Don," he said at last.
"Hard to second-guess this one," Miller replied. "They may all show up at the United Nations on Monday as though nothing had happened. On the other hand, I'd have to suggest that the squeaky-clean image Lugovoy and his staff have projected may be a screen."
"For what purpose?"
Miller shrugged. "I haven't a clue." Emmett closed the file. "Have the New York Bureau stay on this. I want Priority One updates whenever they're available."
"The more I think about it," Miller said, "the more it intrigues me."
"How so?" "What vital secrets could a bunch of Soviet psychologists want to steal?"